The WHO has very much become driven by the large pharmaceutical corporations, the pharmaceutical industry, and its investors, and it is usually they are using it in order to increase their profits. That's what their job is. The problem is that this has been allowed to happen. The whole justification for rushing through these quite draconian agreements is that there is an increasing threat and we have to do something quickly. That there is no evidence of a threat, and the evidence that the WHO relies on to say this, the evidence of the World Bank, that the G20 have relied on to say this, does not show that at all, and they are completely misrepresenting the evidence. People have trouble grasping this because you don't expect the World Bank or the WHO to misrepresent their own evidence, but they are absolutely doing that.
Why should we be concerned about the latest developments with the World Health Organization and paying particular attention to the pandemic agreement and the international health regulations? I'm delighted to be with returning guest David Bell, who has had over 8 years' experience previously working with the World Health Organization and direct experience, as an insider to see how operations may have changed during that time and how they may have evolved since. He's a global health physician. He's a consultant in biotech. And works with the University of Leeds on pandemic preparedness. He's an author at Brownstone Institute and has worked across many different faculties in public health over the years. So it's a delight to have David back to explore these issues. And I'd like, David, if you will, to begin by summarizing in your view why we ought to be concerned, or if we should be concerned, about the pandemic agreements and the international health regulations. A lot of the politicians here in the UK are saying we need increased global cooperation, we need to share information across borders. What's really going on here, and do we need to be concerned?
Yeah, well, thanks for having me back on, Dan. Obviously we do need to be concerned for a number of reasons. I mean, firstly, just that it's really bad public health policy to have highly centralized, homogenous responses to complex emergencies. I mean, that's basic, and the WHO was clear on this 5 years ago. COVID is a good example where it affects elderly people. It hit countries that essentially had, obese old populations, and it barely affected countries, say in sub-Saharan Africa, where half the population is under 20. But the same responses were imposed across each, with a result of over 100 million people on the edge of starvation, etc., the things that have happened there. The basis of public health is that people are free to make their own decisions when they're well-informed. So we're not seeing people being well-informed, and we're seeing their decision-making being taken away. So it's just bad public health policy. It'll drive inequality. It'll drive poverty, as we saw during COVID, and what they're planning is to really do what was the response to COVID, which is extremely harmful, but do that far often and far faster. And it's highly inequitable to particularly low middle income countries, where their decision making very much has been taken away, and we're going to see a drain of wealth from those countries to the sort of old colonial powers. This is very much, I think, driven by a sort of corporate colonialist mindset in the West. There are a lot of reasons, both for people in Western countries who are having a lot of their basic human rights taken away, and for people in the rest of the world to really be concerned.
You've highlighted some of the major concerns, the one-size-fits-all approach, the kind of corporate collusion. Now, these documents refer to pandemics and pandemic preparedness, but if these documents are ratified come May at the World Health Assembly, how will this affect the World Health Organization as a whole? Does it alter the structure and form of the organization? What's your understanding?
Yeah, greatly. The WHO has always essentially been an organization where people talk, they share information, and it gives recommendations on better ways to manage health or ways to cooperate. And the international health regulations, although they have weight under international law, they're essentially recommendations at the moment. What this does is it changes this to countries will undertake to follow recommendations before they're made. So it essentially changes these to requirements, and they're made at a central level. by an organization and an individual that has no direct oversight, no judicial oversight, no particular relationship with the people concerned. And it is, you know, we've seen a change in the WHO over the last 20, 25 years, particularly in the way it's funded, which is reflecting what it's doing now. When the WHO was originally started about 70 years ago, it was on assessed money from countries based on GDP, and they gave that money, nearly all of it, into a central pot. And WHO, with advice from the countries and from its own technical experts, would use that money for where burdens of disease are greatest, and where, you know, where countries ask for help. Now, most of the funding, about 80%, is specified or is thematic, which means that the funder tells WHO what to do with the money. So the WHO, instead of being an independent body, is a tool of the funder. And the other big change is about 20-25% of the funding is now private. And this is nearly all corporations involved in pharmaceuticals or large investors in those corporations. So this has driven a change, really, from WHO being population-based, disease burden-based in its policy, to having policies around commodities and selling commodities, pushing commodities, which generate profit for its investors, essentially its sponsors, which are, you know, the main sponsors are the United States and Germany in terms of countries, which are the big pharmaceutical countries. Germany put its money in BioNTech, et cetera, which produce a Pfizer vaccine. There's a reason why Germany is heavily funding WHO. And the Gates Foundation, which is heavily invested in pharmaceuticals, is essentially a private funder, a private person in the US. So then the next two funders are the European Union and Gavi, which is only about vaccines. It's a public-private partnership. So WHO itself, it's officially an international organization. It's a health arm of the UN. But in effect now, it is a public-private partnership. And the way they work, you take mostly public money, you have private interests on the board and directing it, and they use the public money essentially for their own interests. That's why they get involved in public-private partnerships. So the WHO has very much become driven by the large pharmaceutical corporations, the pharmaceutical industry, and its investors, and it is using it in order to increase their profits. That's what their job is. The problem is that this has been allowed to happen.
Yeah, well, we saw obviously astronomical profiteering from the COVID from many angles, and certainly Big Pharma were one of the biggest gainers from the COVID chapter. And from what you outlined, you can see, I would argue it's a conflict of interest, but many others may say it's in alignment. But
it's an obvious conflict of interest, is a definition of conflict of interest. Yeah,
that's exactly what I would surmise. Now, we obviously saw different protocols implemented during COVID, the Operation Warp Speed, you know, breaking all records for drug development. And for from my take, I would say there was massive corners cut, risks taken, you know, the standard regulatory approvals were not adhered to, the standard trial protocols were not adhered to, the standard marketing protocols were not adhered to. So my concern with this, David, is with the pandemic agreement and the spirit in which it's created would potentially accelerate more of this behavior or normalize this behavior. What would be your understanding of those instruments?
That's what's written into it. So that's what will happen if it's passed. And during COVID, people are saying they're the most tested ever. I mean, this is a completely ridiculous thing to say. The regulatory agencies have made very clear that this isn't the case. So we have some, for instance, the Therapeutic Drugs Administration in Australia, Therapeutic Goods Administration. The report that Pfizer submitted to them, and it makes clear in this report that normally for genetic medicine, and these are genetic medicines, genetic therapeutics, that's what Moderna called this internally, a genetic therapeutic requires carcinogenicity studies to see if it causes cancer, teratogenicity to see if it causes malformations, fetal malformations, etc. Because you're giving genetic material which changes the function of the cell to people. And we know from the bioavailability studies, this goes throughout the body and goes to the fetus in the pregnant woman. So normally you have to do such studies even before you start phase three trials. And you do them on animals, and then you do them if the animal trials are not bad on humans. They did some on animals. They showed a marked increase in fetal abnormalities in rats that had the vaccine compared to those that didn't. They didn't do the cancer ones. And then they just stopped. And they said that they changed the name from a genetic therapeutic to a vaccine. And because it's a vaccine, you don't have to do the normal trials of genetic therapeutic. So they got around it purely with a changing wording of the product. Then they have got around the phase three trials by saying this is so urgent that we just can't wait for normal safety trials. We'll just start injecting people. And then they injected first LD people, as we know, then children and pregnant women, the sort of people you would never inject normally or give a normal medication to until you have really strong evidence that this is safe. So, yeah, they absolutely cut corners. And now the aim of the pandemic agreement is to put in place a mechanism where this will be done again, but repeatedly. And there's a 100-day vaccine initiative at CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations, which is another of these public-private partnerships, bureaucracies that have sort of emerged in this sort of pandemic industry over the last decade or so. And the aim of this is to have, within 100 days of finding potential threat of a virus, to have an mRNA vaccine out and being injected into the general population. So there's absolutely no way you can have sensible safety trials, even in animals, properly over that time. So they're going quite falsely on the basis that the COVID vaccines were completely safe and no other mRNA vaccine will be any different. Therefore, we go down that path. And I think this is a large part of why we're seeing such suppression of any discussion and information on the potential side effects, which appear very clear, of the current mRNA vaccines. And there are both theoretical mechanisms for why they may cause fetal abnormalities, cause cancer, et cetera, et cetera. And there is good evidence of decreased birth rates coincident with the vaccines. There's very good evidence. A paper just came out of Japan of the increase in cancer rates, et cetera. So, you know, there are a lot of red flags here around these vaccines. But the pandemic agreement will allow the WHO to mandate, together with the international health regulations, allow the WHO director general to mandate these potentially. It says that in the IHR amendments. And they also build freedom of liability for the companies that make them. So, I mean, to put this in the big picture of what the amendments to the IHR and the pandemic agreement are doing, that they're building a very large surveillance network, which is extremely expensive, and all countries will be inspected and ensured that they are surveilling for viral variants and new viruses, new outbreaks. They can use the threat of an outbreak. So, you know, you're surveilling for nature, you find that viral variants are normal. This is nature. This is what happens with genomes. They will find these. They, on the basis of a threat, without even any demonstrated harm, they can declare a pandemic, international health emergency, public health emergency of international concern. Then they can order essentially lockdowns. It lists in the IHR quarantine, border closures, travel restrictions, mandated medical examinations, mandated vaccinations, etc. So they'll impose these, they'll close schools, etc., a lot of poverty-inducing responses. And then they'll have a 100-day vaccine 3 months later, which will be the way out of this to get your freedom back. And WHO will, they manage this. They decide when to do it. They decide which companies to make the vaccine, which vaccines will be used. They manage the regulatory part of it to rush them through. And they can force this market by making mandates. So it's, I mean, from the point of view of the vaccine manufacturers, this is just the absolute dream. I don't think we've seen this in any sort of commercial situation I'm aware of, you know, in history. And they're free from liability. The WHO has no judicial oversight. You can't sue the WHO. And so then they'll give people their freedom back and they do this again. And they can suppress, and countries undertake to manage information that the public can access during this time. So they can censor and make it very difficult to oppose this. And I mean, as we know, that the same pharmaceutical corporations, they sponsor the media very heavily. They sponsor politicians, etc. So we're seeing, you know, going back to the first question, what is wrong with these and with public health? This is where public health has gone on an international level. And people don't grasp it because they think that WHO and all these organizations are there for the greater good, altruistic. And most people who work in them probably join with that intent at some stage. But they have been taken over. It's inevitable that this was going to happen once we allowed large private interests in and we allowed the funders to determine how their money is used, because their interest is not, you know, the interest of a pharmaceutical company is not getting more health workers in some village in Malawi, even though that may be by far the best intervention to save lives. It is selling vaccines and selling medicines in order to drive profit for their investors. That's why they're involved. So we're seeing the inevitable result of that happening and of the same companies controlling the media and the messaging around it.
Yeah, I mean, David, what you've described is, it brings back awful nightmares from the last 3 years, because as you've described is essentially what happened during COVID. And one of the key arguments that I don't hear discussed is actually the rationale of needing something like this for the inevitability of a further outbreak in the future. Yeah. Because by all intents and purposes, if you look back over the last 100 years, depending on which time frame you look at, where you start the counter, 3 to 4 major pandemics of any serious consequence in that time frame. My concern around this surveillance element is, it's like anything. If you walk in the woods every day and you don't deliberately look for squirrels, you may never see a squirrel, but the moment you start looking for squirrels, you see squirrels everywhere. And the same is true here, and we've already seen it during the course of the last few years. There was a, you know, sudden hysteria around monkeypox and other things. And the moment I've never seen anything like it. And I was shocked with the degree of sensationalism around every new variation, even the smallest changes. It was always speculated to be the most virulent, the most severe, and a lot of the things that were stated. And as you know, I spoke to lots of people in the scientific community. The virologists have said this is just the natural evolution of a virus, and that they're
completely normal.
Completely normal, and it's highly improbable that they become more serious in terms of consequence to human health. The opposite is true. But with this surveillance mechanism, that for me is the biggest part, because even though statistically it's highly improbable that we would face a naturally occurring event, and of course, probably save the debate for where it came from for another time.
Yeah.
the premise here is that this all becomes normalized. What I'm curious about, David, is how will it specifically change? Because without such an instrument, effectively, the WHO assumed that role in many ways. Is the primary difference this now creates a more direct relationship with the nation state? Does it create a more command and control type relationship, moving further away from that advisory regulatory approach? Because we still saw what you've just described happen, but does this normalize it and make it more of a centralized response that's coordinated by the WHO. Is that a ramification?
It does, and that's the only reason for doing this. We already have interstitial health regulations that allow coordination and allow recommendations to be made. And we hear some really silly messaging, which is never evidenced, about how the COVID proves that we need more coordination, da-da-da. What would that coordination have done? Absolutely nothing, because border closures did nothing to COVID. I mean, you close a border when the virus is on both sides of the border, you're not actually changing anything. The travel restrictions, et cetera, did nothing. The viruses, respiratory viruses, aerosolized viruses, you don't stop that by closing workplaces so that everyone goes back to some highly dense, slum or something in an African city. All you do is cause poverty when you do that. So there is nothing that would have really dramatically changed the trajectory of COVID, except perhaps not doing gain-of-function research in the first place. This is all driven by this idea that there's a natural and increasing, and that they use terms, the World Bank, the WHO, et cetera, use terms like existential threat of increasing pandemics, tripling of pandemics over the next decade, et cetera. The Spanish flu was 100 years ago, over 100 years ago. We didn't have antibiotics. Most people died from secondary bacterial infections. Anthony Fauci's written a paper on that. Since then, there was a flu outbreak in the late 50s, one in the late 60s. Woodstock was held in the middle of it. People just got on with life. Slightly more people than normal died of the flu. Since then, we haven't really had one. And there's a big, a lot of messaging, and the whole justification for rushing through these quite draconian agreements is that there is an increasing threat and we have to do something quickly. That there is no evidence of a threat, and the evidence the WHO relies on to say this, the evidence of the World Bank, that the G20 have relied on to say this, does not show that at all, and they are completely misrepresenting the evidence. People have trouble grasping this because you don't expect the World Bank or the WHO to misrepresent their own evidence. But they are absolutely doing that. So the WHO will list diseases like cholera and yellow fever, flu variants, et cetera, and say, we're getting more and more. Here it's all the ones for the last 20 years. But ignoring the fact that 50 years ago, 100 years ago, this were several fold worse. The infectious disease mortality is steadily decreasing. We were detecting a lot more because we invented PCR, we invented antigen tests, we invented serology tests, and we got them out into countries that didn't have them before. We had much better surveillance mechanisms. So we see a lot more of these variants. We see diseases popping up. But over the last 20 years, based on the main databases like the Gideon database, which is the biggest database of outbreaks globally, there's a reduction in outbreaks and in mortality. So when they're saying there's an increase, they're absolutely misinforming us. They're speaking falsely. Their own data shows quite the opposite. And this is really important to understand because, yes, the pandemics will happen. Outbreaks happen. Yes, it makes sense to have a sensible, proportionate discussion on this. Probably not spending over $30 billion a year as they're proposing when we only spend $3 billion on malaria that kills far more people and far younger. But to have a sensible cooperative agreement that is proportionate to the actual burden, which is decreasing, makes sense. They're pushing quite the opposite. They're pushing unprecedented concentration of money on this very, very small burden of acute outbreaks. For the only logical reason, it's not a public health reason, the only logical reason is this pharma-driven profit motives that we discussed.
Yeah, well, I concur on that one. The most common counter argument I hear, David, is that the idea that this is actually overriding any national sovereignty is flawed, and that you know, even if nation states are subscribing to these treaties and the amendments, they still have autonomy over their own public health decisions. To what extent do you think that's actually true?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. We've seen Tedros, the Director General of WHO, twice recently in major speeches say there's no interest in the WHO in dictating or taking over sovereignty, and that the pandemic agreement specifically doesn't do that. We saw a letter from the, you know, as they call themselves, the elders, self-credentialed ex-leaders and other public health people, recently that said the same thing and talked just about the pandemic agreement. There is the UN Foundation put out a blog the other day just saying the same thing about the pandemic agreement. They're deliberately ignoring the International Health Regulation amendments, which say exactly that. That countries will undertake ahead of time to do everything that WHO, the Director General and the WHO say. So the only reason to change the IHR amendments, which are being voted on at the same time, and the pandemic agreement specifically says is compatible with the IHR amendments. The only reason to make those essentially requirements rather than recommendations is so that the WHO can tell people what to do. And take over powers which were previously invested in individuals and in national health systems. So you can argue about the strict definition of sovereignty. Certainly these are taking decision-making that is currently in individuals and nations and putting it in the hands of an individual, actually, to use whenever that individual states. As long as that individual states, and that individual is heavily influenced by private corporate money where there's clearly vested interests. So that is what is happening. To me, that's obviously, certainly in spirit, a loss of sovereignty. Even if our leaders, who are off to the Davos every year and very much dependent on pharma and so on for their re-election, even if they voluntarily give up those powers, they're voluntarily giving up sovereignty, still giving up sovereignty. So to say that you will sign the agreement but you won't let that happen basically means your signature doesn't mean anything, your country's word doesn't mean anything. So you're signing an agreement, you're signing a treaty, but you have no intention of keeping it. Now, countries do that, but it's not an honourable way to conduct a country's business. So I think it is giving up sovereignty. I struggle with the arguments that suggest that that's not true.
Yeah. I mean, even in the absence of such a document, the generalised central lockstep approach showed that the kind of groupthink around this dominates. And even if the expressed terms aren't explicitly ceding sovereignty in the final document, it's the spirit of which it is created, I think. It's the same as any national law. You know, you can behave lawfully without knowing the law. You behave as you perceive is lawful. And the same is true under the spirit of these documents. It creates, it normalizes the conditions in which we've lived within. During the course of the COVID chapter, and that for me is part of the concern,
there's a strong coercive component as well from the World Bank and the IMF, who are very much on board with this, and it appears, it's hard to know it appears that there were requirements during COVID, particularly for low middle income countries, to do this. I think COVID has greatly increased the foreign debt of low- and middle-income countries. So they are now much more beholden to these large financial institutions, which state that they are absolutely on board with WHO and with these agreements. There's also, there's an interesting clause in the US National Defense Authorization Act 2023, which actually mentions the international health regulations and talks about the sense of Congress being that they should deal with countries that don't adequately manage internal outbreaks. So you can interpret that as you will, but it appears to suggest that there is a feeling internationally that powerful countries have a right to impose these restrictions, their restrictions on low-income countries when the time comes.
Yeah, I mean, so the way you've described it with the funding and the conflicts of interest, I mean, I've heard other people make this kind of reference, like an OPEC-like document. It's with the oil industry, it feels very much like, you even use the term pandemic industry, it feels like it has become an industry. And the warnings were there prior to COVID, but now, to me, they're stark. And we're closing in on the deadline, and this is coming up very, very soon. I mean, we're recording this on the 17th of April, and they could be ratified and approved by the end of May. And it seems that governments are willingly ceding power and doing this. And I repeatedly ask myself why, and you've outlined some of the reasons why that might be in terms of the incentives. But is there also an argument that governments are fully aware of how poorly the response was to COVID? Because the outlier was always Sweden, and everyone pointed the fingers and said they're throwing their citizens under the bus, they're being reckless, yet almost on every measure they have outperformed any other nation. And in fact, even the other Scandinavian countries had more of a light touch approach, like Norway, similar results, yet all of the ones that adopted these draconian and authoritarian responses, which are going to be normalized in these documents, have had wretched responses, both in terms of public health, the economy. You've mentioned poverty several times, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at the link between poverty and disease, because there is just not that. And again, off the back of the last major recession, 2007-2008, it had a significant impact on public health because of people's affordability to live well. So, to what extent do you think there is an opportunity to prevent this from happening? Because there are people making arguments around the procedural side, Article 55, and because it's almost smoke and mirrors. There's very little transparency on this, to the point where I was at the there was a petitions committee event in Britain where the issue was debated, and the one of the leaders of the debate refused to give the names of those involved in the negotiation, so that we don't even have the opportunity to put our points across directly to the people who are negotiating on part of our nation. So it's not only completely done within secret, we don't really have a transparent way to influence its outcome. But what do you think the likelihood is that this will be approved? Because of course they've gone to a delay, they've had to extend the negotiations. There's a new round of negotiations, a ninth round of negotiations that were unforeseen. Is there any prospect that these things could be stopped, in your view?
Yeah, so both of them are still being negotiated. As you mentioned, Article 55, which says that there has to be, and the IHR, that they have standing under international law, one of the clauses says there has to be 4 months to review before a vote. And there's a good reason for that, because, there are 300 amendments that are being discussed at the moment. These have implications on health systems, human rights, economies, etc., in countries. You can't vote on something like that without first having a long time to understand the implications and whether it's a good idea for your country. So there's a deliberate effort to stop that review from happening, and the justification for that effort is the falsehood that outbreaks are rapidly increasing and this is an existential threat that we're dealing with. That's a false. For natural outbreaks, that's certainly false. So we can assume that it is because there's a profit motive, etc., around this. There are other reasons other than public health. So repeat your question, Dan.
Well, I suppose I was kind of pondering whether there's any procedural or legal opportunity to stop this.
Well, there is. So countries could say that they need that 4 months, and that should stop it from happening. The Dutch Parliament have just passed a resolution, a vote saying that that should happen. Otherwise, they should vote against. It needs quite a few more countries to do that. It's been discussed in the Uganda Parliament. There's a lot of interest in Africa because this is seen very much as a colonialist, quite rightly, is it? Reimposition of colonialism.
Could you elaborate on that? What can you explain how it mean there?
Yeah, it's what happened in COVID was a huge wealth extraction from African countries towards Western economies, in particular Western corporate. And the colonialism, you know, the European colonialism was run on sort of corporate government partnership, the East India companies, etc. And we're seeing it's a very similar pattern with now with the pharma industry and being run through the WHO and with these large Western backers. So, and it, the decision-making is very much Western-based. This is, you know, COVID was perceived as a rich country problem, but it wasn't a problem in, you know, nearly all African countries. They have much larger health burdens, other priorities. So this is, it's sort of taken over. It's both from an economic point of view and the point of view of power and decision-making. It's taking power out of those countries and essentially putting it in Geneva and in the companies and the countries that run, that are most influential there.
I mean, to me, it's a shocking prospect. And, you know, unfortunately, I've got clear awareness, and being able to speak to people like yourself brings even greater clarity around those consequences. And I would imagine that people listening to this for the first time and they're saying this is all very rational arguments, but there's still a lot of support for this, and I don't understand how anyone would support this. So what's the straw man argument in favor of this? You know, what's driving the tide outside of the pharmaceutical industrial complex on this?
Well, yeah, there is this narrative that things are getting much worse, that we're having more and more outbreaks. It's a false narrative. It can be, we showed in the report we put out from the University of Leeds that this was false. Yes, outbreaks occur, but certainly the impact is getting less, and certainly natural outbreaks. And if you take out COVID, very little has happened. The West African Ebola outbreak is often mentioned as an example. I mean, there is 3 or 4 months of inaction from WHO, which allowed that to become so big. But so big is 11,000 deaths. That's a lot of deaths, but it's 4 days of tuberculosis deaths. So, you know, to put these in context, and that's one of the biggest outbreaks we had, 4 days of tuberculosis. So it is ludicrous to say that outbreaks are an existential threat, etc. But that is what we are constantly being told, and people start to believe this. They read it in the media all the time. The World Bank says it, the G20 says it, the WHO says it. It's hard to grasp that these organizations are actually not telling the truth and are essentially lying in a lot of what they say. So most people struggle to accept that because it's a huge mind shift, and it opens all sorts of problems with what on earth is going on, and, you know, do we really have democracies? Who really decides who are the leaders of our political parties, etc.? So most people don't want to go down that, you know, people call it rabbit holes, but they're not really. This is the way humans work. You know, if you're running a large company, or you're running Vanguard or BlackRock, one of the big financial institutions that have the major shareholdings in all of these companies and in the media, etc., then you will use those assets to generate more income because that's your job. So you will use your media assets to confuse people and convince them that they're in risk of getting sicker. If you've got a lot of pharmaceutical investments that you need to make money out of, it would be stupid not to do that, you know, unless you're a moral person particularly. But from a purely financial point of view, they're doing these big institutions that essentially run Western capitalism now. They're doing what their job is, which is to use their assets to make the maximum amount of money. This means convincing people that there is a threat when there is not. And if you haven't grasped that that is going on, then it's quite reasonable to accept, well, they probably are telling the truth. maybe we should do something, maybe, although I haven't seen people dropping dead around me, there is a huge threat and lots of people dropping dead elsewhere. I know people in Australia who were convinced that here in the US, people were dropping dead like flies because the media told them every day. So I think a lot of people going on, along with this, because including politicians, because they believe what they're being told, they don't realize the amount of false messaging that is driving this.
I concur. It's which explains the lack of media coverage, because you know that's the common objection I get. Well, if it was as bad as you're saying, Dan, then why wouldn't the media be talking about this? And the reality is, there is no investigative journalism in any of these major publications anymore. They are beholden in the same way to the same conflicts as you outlined. But we live in such a monopolistic world, a heavily globalized, centralized monopoly, that many of these organizations are interlinked. I saw a infographic just yesterday that showed that 12 food companies own 500 of the biggest, 500 plus of the biggest food companies on Earth. And you can obviously see how these linkages are formed. And that's the same in the pharmaceutical industry and the media industry. They're all, they're parallel. It's a complex web, but they're all interlinked. And
the major shareholders in Pfizer and AstraZeneca are the same as the major shareholders in CNN, Time Warner, and in the New York Times, and in Google, Apple, Facebook, etc. So it's the same controlling interests in these. And when you see that, then this is just obvious that this is going to happen. These conflicts of interest, of course, will happen. When 90% of a drug regulatory agency's income comes from the pharmaceutical industry, obviously they're not going to keep rejecting all their products. The New York Times, you talk about the media, if the New York Times came out and said, the Pfizer vaccines, Moderna vaccines, they showed the animal trials and the increase in fetal abnormalities in rats, etc., that they showed that they concentrated in the ovary and the adrenal glands and the liver. They showed that they concentrated on what VS is showing, an associated increase in mortality, etc. Then, and they said, so maybe we should stop pushing these out and do some proper trials. If the New York Times said that, they would probably lose the bulk of their pharma sponsorship, their pharma advertising, which is the main advertising revenue for the paper. So they would have to sack half their staff. It's not rocket science to understand. It's not some big conspiracy that all these people are conspiring together for some global governance scenario. I mean, there may be people at the top who would like that, but the people at the New York Times, they just want a job. And they know that if they tell the truth, or they do solid investigative journalism, then their paper might fall because it only survives advertising now.
Yeah, that's why the alternative media landscape is so important.
It is vital,
or the new media landscape, as I prefer to call it. David, I think one of the key things we've landed upon is this false notion that we are living in a world where there is greater threat of pandemic type risks. I suppose I would put also an asterisk on that, because the documents, the way I assess them, state that it widens, it seems to broaden the scope of what could be deemed a public health emergency in which these types of powers could be executed upon, which to me is quite frightening. People have talked about climate related lockdowns and things like that, and it's the way that it's worded is so broad, that the parameters are so wide, that to me it feels like anything could become a public health emergency, and all of a sudden travel restrictions, whatever may follow. But for some reason, people aren't understanding that argument, and therefore even to explore alternatives, because the question is, well, not if not this, then what? Because that's the other barrier I come across. So what's your response to that? What is the alternative? Does it require an alternative?
Yeah, so were we all dropping dead in 2019? We weren't, actually. We were pretty much fine, most of us. We were better off then than today globally, because we have seen such a shift in wealth over the last 4 or 5 years, that there is a lot more poverty now, a lot more people on the edge of starvation globally. There's an increase in other diseases, cancer, malaria, etc. So, outbreaks occur. We have much, what we die of is cancer, heart disease, tuberculosis in other countries, diseases such as that, not, except in rare circumstances, acute infectious disease outbreaks. So
it's almost
may need to do nothing, but whatever we need to do needs to be proportionate to everything else. There is nothing in either the IHR amendments or the pandemic agreement that talks about assessing things proportionate to the greater burdens of disease elsewhere and making sure that we don't divert resources, which we absolutely will, from other diseases to this very small burden of outbreaks. So inevitably, these will make things worse because more people will die of other diseases because we're diverting resources, we'll be closing schools more often, making people poorer generally. So people will die younger because of this. And that's just orthodox public health tells us that. So perhaps we're better off doing nothing new. If we want to do anything new, then we have time to stop and think it through, proportionate to other diseases, which we're not doing at the moment, and with an honest evaluation of the risk, which is not happening and not being presented to us by WHO, World Bank, or G20 or other institutions. And then from the basic ethical principles that we developed after the Second World War around human rights, absence of coercion, and to just the very basics of, why did we have independent regulatory agencies? Why do we have our separation of powers? It is insane to give one organization into the EBA that has no judicial oversight the power to declare a pandemic, to decide what response will be done, to impose that response, to at our freedom of liability, etc., and then make money from it, because they'll be paid for this. And of course that causes corruption. Of course that will be used corruptly, because throughout human history that has happened, and that is why we have separation of powers. It's why we have constitutions, which we have to stick to, even if we don't like it this year. And it's why, it's why greed is a thing, and we structure society to take that into account and to stop it from destroying, the basic interactions between people. And this is all being taken away with these agreements. We're just ignoring these basic precepts on which society is built, basic precepts of conflict of interest, of human rights. And why are we doing that? Because of a completely false fear. So I understand. I know people who are genuinely scared because they've believed all this. But, the whole, people need to grasp how insane this is. So we probably need to do very little new for pandemics. We need to do something about heart disease. We need to do something about, in the US, people with life expectancy was dropping due to metabolic disease prior to COVID. That should be an emergency. There's a cancer emergency at the moment. There are far more pressing issues than natural outbreaks. If we're worried about bioweapons and unnatural outbreaks, then that's a completely another story. And of course you wouldn't delegate that to someone in Geneva to look after, because that's a national security interest. So you would keep that within the country. So there's no logic to any of this, unless you're a group of people at the very top who don't have a strong allegiance to any country in particular, don't have very strong morals, and are really interested in making lots of money and getting lots of power. So it's hard to see what other drivers are behind it.
You've made so many strong points, David. I think the points around directing attention, focus, funding towards the actual root cause of disease and ill health and the primary causes of mortality would represent a significant shift. And I thought throughout COVID that COVID became the big C. It overtook cancer as the big C. And throughout the entire period, I thought if you had this laser focus on heart disease or obesity or cancer, I mean, cancer, what progress could be made with cancer if you'd spent 4 years obsessing over globally on how to tackle cancer? But the problem is, with all of these healthcare elements, even then, it's the pharmaceutical industrial complex, which, and as an entrepreneurial mind and a problem solver, I always go back to first principles to understand what's actually causing this and what's the most appropriate remedy, which you said, you know, sometimes it's actually, you know, it could be nutrition or it could be sending, appropriate healthcare, which is the other argument here, because all this centralization, the United Kingdom, the healthcare system here is falling apart. You know, there's some great hard workers in the NHS, but quite frankly, it's not fit for purpose. Where is the allocation of resource to localize community healthcare? And people talk a good game about community healthcare, but the reality is community healthcare is being replaced by centralized global healthcare. And this is, and it's not healthcare is not, I struggle to use the term healthcare in a conversation like this. It's not healthcare. It's drug management. And that's the reality.
It is. I mean, the best you can do for healthcare, and it's shown repeatedly in low income countries, is to increase the very basic access to basic management, to sanitation, clean water, good nutrition. They're the basics. And certain vaccines help. Obviously, essential medication, antibiotics help, etc. But yeah, the reason we live longer in the West is primarily better living conditions, sanitation, better diet. And there's overwhelming evidence for that. No one questions it. This is what I was taught in medical school. There's false narratives now about, you know, it's all about vaccines. Of course it isn't about vaccines. You look at the trajectory of life expectancy, and vaccines have helped a little bit at the end. They came very late. You know, there are other questions on whether giving 70 vaccines to a child by the age of 10, as we do in the US, is a good idea or not. But we don't know, because we never actually done sensible trials to determine that. But so if we're concerned about public health, there are, and as you said, if we had this sort of laser focus, we could do enormous amounts of, make enormous progress on this, on metabolic disease, which is a huge problem in this country, the US, with overweight and hyperinsulinemia, diabetes, etc., which, the reason people die of viruses such as COVID is, it was age and it was metabolic disease. So if you're serious about pandemic preparedness from viruses, the first thing you would do is improve nutrition and reduce metabolic disease. And you would focus on that, and that would make people live longer anyway. And when an outbreak comes along, they will be much more resilient towards it. But we're not hearing anything at all about that. There is zero about that in the pandemic agreement. And the Ministry of International Health Regulations about even discussing that sort of thing. So because you cannot concentrate wealth through that. But you can concentrate wealth through commodities, through selling vaccines in particular, because you can mandate them. And you can give them even to healthy people. Antibiotics are great, but you don't make much money because you only give them to people when they're sick. But that's why weight loss medications is such a focus, because people take them for life. You can mandate vaccines to everyone in the population now, and you've got an absolutely guaranteed income. And the other thing with vaccines is, in many countries and with the new pandemic agreement, then globally, there's essentially a freedom from liability if you start harming or killing people.
Which is exactly what we've seen during this time. And the same mechanisms prevent any proper scrutiny. And here we are in a vicious circle that will be repeated if we don't take action. So we've talked a little bit about potential delays and things that could influence the outcome here. You've helped create an open letter, David. Do you want to just tell us a little bit about the open letter and what that outlines? I'm sure basis this discussion is included, but what's the hope that that open letter will achieve, and how can people find out more about it?
Yeah, so there is a website. I hope you can put up that shows where it is. We're hoping people will sign it, just to make a point. But the main intent of it is as a basis for countries and politicians and other actors in this to use. So it's just pointing out the truth, the reality about pandemic risk, and that there is not such an urgency that we need to do away with all normal processes. Is pointing out the issues around Article 55, that countries do have, WHO has a responsibility and countries have a need to have time to consider these, and they're still being negotiated. So there is no reason to vote on these at the end of May. There's no public health reason. There's not even a reason for WHO. They can call an emergency session of the World Health Assembly in 4 months' time if they want to. They've done that before. They can do that. So there's no reason to ram these through in May. And there's also a huge equity issue, which we point out in the letter, because if you're the United States or the United Kingdom, you can probably put a couple hundred people on this, bureaucrats, and at least get a decent idea of what implications this has for your country within 2-3 weeks, perhaps, at a high level. If you're a lower middle-income country with less resources for that, firstly, you've had less input into the process because you can't keep people in Geneva in the meeting room month after month after month as this has happened. And secondly, there's no way that you can assess the impact on your much larger disease burdens, the shift of resources, whether you can afford that, the implications for your economy, for your national debt, for human rights within your country, how it affects your constitution. You can't assess any of that. So there's also a huge equity issue. And WHO likes to talk constantly about equity while it sort of reintroduces this colonialist agenda. If they're interested in equity, the whole point of that is to give people an equal basis on which to assess things like this. And there's a disproportionate inability of lower-income countries, less-resource countries, to do this. So the letter is really pointing this out. And we're not, it is seeking a postponement until there is a clear understanding and a better evidence base behind these, so that if we do come up with an agreement, it is an appropriate and proportionate one, and not a rush one, which will, as is written now, will inevitably cause net harm.
Absolutely. I mean, on that concluding point, it bemuses me that how one could even consider a pandemic agreement without at least having some form of independent international inquiry into the WHO's role in COVID. We're seeing, obviously, the public inquiry in the UK, and it's heavily biased. It's almost got to the point where it's pointless, and I'm sure an international exercise would be the same at global level. But to me, it's always putting the cart before the horse. Why would you grant additional responsibilities or powers to such an organization without first asking the question, did they do the right thing during the last pandemic to warrant them being involved in any level in any future potential event, let alone the probability of such an event occurring within our lifetime? So it's frankly shocking that we're in this situation. I'm so grateful that there are people like you, David, who are rationally bringing rationality back to the table, and you succinctly explaining why we need to care. Because ultimately, in order to influence this, I do think people need to take it upon themselves to try and help transform this outcome. Because the risks are unbearable in my view, but many people have different degrees of relationship to this, but we've all been through COVID. We've all experienced firsthand what can happen when You know, you follow these types of protocols and the impact it has on the quality of our lives, our health, economy, our children, you know, the vast collateral damage of the things that we've witnessed during the last few years. And yet no one is talking about the risks of normalizing all of that and going through that again. So, David, thank you so much for all the good work that you're doing on this and, you know, for bringing an academic mind to it as well, and the work that you're doing at the University of Leeds to provide supporting evidence that brings credence to the argument we're not facing these existential threats that are positioned in a way to generate fear so that people comply with these new documents. So thank you so much, and thanks so much for being here again with us on the show, and keep up the good work, and we'll keep our audience posted on the latest developments. And the link to the open letter will, of course, be in the description. So please do check that out and sign if you feel compelled, and do share it, because we do need more and more people to participate in these kind of campaigns. The future is in our hands if we take it, but it's down to us to take that piece of responsibility and join the fight for health autonomy in the future.
Thanks, Dan.
Welcome to Free Humanity. I'm inviting you to join us on the Road to Geneva, our exciting new campaign to resist the World Health Organization. The Road to Geneva campaign will culminate in a pan-European convoy that's going to converge outside the city of Geneva on Friday, the 31st of May, ahead of a mass peaceful rally that's going to be taking place outside the World Health Organization on Saturday, the 1st of June. If you want to join us, head over to roadtogeneva.com. You'll find out about our latest convoy plans and the wider campaign to challenge the WHO. And I hope we'll see you on the road to Geneva.